Okay, yes, so I'm going to talk about Padmasambhava as a magician. So just start by saying, talking a little bit about magic, what it is and how it becomes useful within the spiritual life. There are two kinds of magic, really. In the Western tradition, anyway, it's recognised that there are two broad categories of magic. There's three, actually. Actually, there's four. there's illusionists who just do tricks. They make you think something. And there is in the Buddhist tradition, there's a classic idea of an illusionist, and he is someone who goes to a crossroads, presumably a public place, and makes an elephant appear when there isn't an elephant there. So that is the illusionist. There's also the conjurer, and a conjurer is someone who raises spirits, often spirits of the dead. Then there is what we can call lower magic. This is the kind of magic that's involved in, you know, getting yourself a lover, getting yourself some wealth, killing an enemy, those sorts of practical things. The kind of things very much of the world, and the magician in this case will give you spells to make these things happen, or will perform certain rituals to make these things happen. Milarepa was, of course, a magician of this style in the early part of his life, causing floods and tempests to ruin crops and so on, and even kill people. So he killed people, we're told, by using this sort of level of magic. However, these sort of things are just there to manipulate the objective world. They're really a kind of... they're an outcrop of people realising that they don't have power. So they resort to magic in order to gain power to do the kind of things that they want to do in the world. Ensure crops, change the weather, tell the future, and so on. Now, there's also what in the Western tradition is referred to as higher magic. And higher magic is based on the recognition that there are spiritual forces present in the world, existent in the world, in the universe, and those spiritual forces are also manifest in the individual human being. This is the basic Neoplatonic idea. It's often stated as above, so below. So there are forces in the world which are reflected, which are existent also in the human psyche. Now, in this case, what the magician is interested in doing is building a relationship between the force in the universe and the force within his own self. Yeah, so to evoke within himself forces, that spiritual forces that are functioning in the universe. Examples of these forces. I remember one of my problems when I was younger was trained as a physicist, by the way, just to give some context to this. So very much brought up as a scientist, and one of my issues is, do gods exist? Yeah. Now, of course, what I was doing, I was thinking, do gods exist materially? Can we see them? Can we photograph them? Can we measure them in some way? Can we detect them in some sort of material way? Is that possible? And then I remember reading Lama Govinda wrote a book of essays on Tibet. And in one of these essays, he said that Tibetan, Himalayan people generally are totally confident that deities live on the top of mountains. They have no doubt about it. They will discuss it quite literally, you know, that they're usually female deities as well, and they live on these mountains. But no Tibetan would ever expect to go to the top of a mountain and see the deity. And they're quite happy with this kind of double use of language. And it struck me that this was a kind of key, in a way, to understanding the nature of gods and spirits. Though we can talk about them, they do exist, but they don't exist in this kind of material, measurable way. A very good example is love. Now, love, well, let's say compassion. Compassion is a force that exists in the universe. We can see it in up there in the world. We can see it functioning in the world. But it's also something that functions within us. Yeah. So fear, for example, when you get panic around some, you know, some disaster, there's a human panic. You can see fear and panic existing as a force. Agreed, it's made up of those individual people, but nonetheless, there is a force there which has been evoked that those people get involved with. So there's panic, there's fear existent in the outside world that links in with the kind of reflection of that within people. So this to me was a kind of an answer of, well, what do Tara, Avalokiteshvara, Manjushri, example, do they exist? Are they forces in the universe? Well, they are. To me, it seems quite clear that Tara is a force within the universe. But she's also something which is existent in the individual psyche. So what we can do with magic is make a connection between the god, between the deva, between the Buddha or Bodhisattva, and whatever that is actually within our own psyche. Now, all of the attempts at what I've been calling the lower magic, those things have really been more or less taken over by science. You know, if you want to kill someone, well, use gun or poison or something, some technological method of doing it. It's far more efficient than spells. If you want to make someone love you, if you want to take advantage of them, let's say, well, there are drugs to do that, unfortunately. So, you know, these things are, we can tell the weather now. We can't actually change the weather, but we can certainly tell the future as far as the weather is concerned to some degree through scientific method. So science in a way has taken over that kind of realm. But it seems to me that science can't take over the realm of the higher magic, because that realm is not susceptible to measurement. It's not susceptible to in order to apply science to something, you've got to be able to measure it in some way or another. It's all based on numbers. The Pythagoreans, who thought everything was based on numbers, were very mystical about the numbers, but in a way they were right. You can understand the natural world by measuring it. However, you can't measure love. You can't measure hate. You can't measure fear. There's no instruments that we've developed yet that enable us to do that. So they fall outside of the realm of science. However, this inner world, I'm going to call it the inner world now, the inner world of, say, dreams, visions, meditation experience, and so on, it's not applicable, we can't apply rationality to that realm. It's not a rational realm. It's not rational in its unfolding. So we need to engage with it in a different way. And the way that we engage with it, of course, is by using the imagination. This is why the imagination and what has been called the imaginal faculty are so crucial in the spiritual life, because we're dealing with something which is not accessible to rationality, but it is accessible to the imagination. The arts, this is why Bhante, for example, has really stressed the arts, because the arts is our Western the means of expression of the imagination through poetry, through literature, through painting, sculpture, and so on. So the arts are very important in the spiritual life as their, as it were, an accepted form of imaginative investigation. But they tend to be sort of fairly individualistic. You know, artists will express their own personal imagination. The advantage with a system, an imaginal system, is that it can be shared by a community of people. Now, this is what I think has happened in the past. So, I've been looking at certain kind of magical occult traditions from about late 1500s, a bit earlier than that, even onwards. And what's happened is you've got a number of different systems developing. So astrology was clearly one everybody took astrology seriously, right the way through into the middle of the 18th century. There is alchemy, which was developing as a kind of mystification of the technology of the day. You've got the discovery of the classical gods. So there's the classical mystery religions where, you know, where people in those classical times, not all religions were mystical, but some of them were. In some of those religions, the goal of it was to actually unify with the deity. This is particularly true, of course, with Dionysius. So that was the kind of the main mystery religion. But there were others to do with Apollo, Venus, Mars, and so on. So if you wanted to evoke the kind of the aggressive part of your soul, if you were going into battle and you wanted to get in touch with that raw, you know, brute force, you would pray to Mars. You would go and do a ceremony to Mars in order to connect with that. If you wanted to develop, softer, gentler virtues in order to seduce someone, you'd go to Venus or one of the goddesses like that. I mean, so for them, the classical deities were evocations of certain spirits that they wanted to strengthen within themselves. So by the 16th century, we've got astrology, we've got classical religions. We've got the rediscovery of Hermetic magic, which I'll say a little bit more about later on, which they thought was really ancient, but actually turned out to be from around the 2nd century AD in Egypt. You've got Gnosticism. You've got Jewish magic in the Kabbalah. That was also becoming known through Arab writing at that time. So there was a whole range of all of these different sort of, let's call them imaginative systems, yeah, that were sort of roughly consistent within themselves. But the advantage that they had is that they weren't rationally consistent. There was lots and lots of wiggle room. So you could use the various, let's say, the different deities, the Greek deities, you could use them to sort of talk about inner experience and outer activity, but they weren't sufficiently defined that you had to see them in one particular way. For example, there are some forms of Venus in which she holds a sword. Yeah? So she's sort of married to a certain extent to Mars. There are certainly images of Mars where he is very feminine. You know, he's lounged back on a chaise longue. Sorry, this is all pre-feminism. You'll have to forgive me if I slip into that kind of language. But, you know, he's lounged back on the chaise longue eating grapes and stuff. Not at all Mars-like. But that was okay. You know, people were able to move their gods and goddesses around a bit in order to accommodate the sort of deeper spiritual experiences that they were having. So you've broadly got a system which has got a high degree of flexibility within it, in order to investigate inner experience. Another thing about the inner realm, the inner experience that's connected with this, is that it's highly individualised. I've been talking with some friends recently about, you know, you can have very profound meditation experiences, but it's almost impossible to describe it to anybody else. You either find yourself slipping back into using sort of rather hackneyed expressions, you know, oh, I overcame the subject-object dichotomy, which, you know, oh, well, yeah, fine, that's, but I mean, supposing you had, you know, what if you really had, even if it was just for a few moments? That is a very, very important experience, but we don't have the language, really. Or else, you know, it could be, I don't know, something completely outrageous, you know. Venus descended upon me and sort of totally engulfed me, and I was sort of, it was just bliss and ecstasy, and I disappeared. And I know what my friends would say to me. They say, oh, you know, here he is, you know, off thinking about the ladies again. So but it could have been, oh, in fact it was. It was a very profound experience. So it's because it's so individualized, A, it's difficult to talk about. I also think that that means that we can't always expect other people to understand even those experiences we have, which are very, very deep, very profound. I've got some very good friends who just don't understand the kind of language in which I experience these things. And I suppose it's similar for them with me. You know, it's it's not even just a matter of goodwill. Sometimes it's a matter of just the way that you're set up. So we need these symbols, and if we've got a generally accepted common range of symbols, well, then we've got a better chance of understanding each other. For example, if you say, I really connected with Avalokiteshvara. Now, we probably all know in our own ways what that means to some degree. Yeah. So by having a common set of symbols, we've got some chance of communicating. We've also got some language for actually experiencing these things ourselves. So, yeah. I mean, we do have Western traditions, the ones I've mentioned, and that it's really interesting following the history of them, because there's a more or less continuous history, except through the 17th century, when rationalism was on the rise, and all of these mystery religions, in a way, went underground. It was carried through mainly by the Rosicrucians and by the Masons, another trade who saw the mystic side of their trade and sort of had secret societies that were also quite sort of mystic. So it has come through to us, and, you know, there's a lot of interest in various occult systems today. So, that, you know, the material is there. But, of course, in Buddhism, we've got a very rich tradition of our own, within the Vajrayana particularly. We've got an incredibly rich system of images. And so by using them in this more sort of magical way, by recognizing their existence both externally and internally, and trying to build that connection, we're able to sort of bring that whole field alive. So Padmasambhava has obviously an important role to play in this area. He is the magician. Externally, he's a magician. You know, he knows the forces at work in the universe, and he can connect with them. And through connecting with them, he can, well, control them, but not manage, really, rather than control. But by reflecting on him, we can, by using this same sort of, let's say, magical principle, we can start to recognize within ourselves our own, as it were, inner magician. We can recognize the ability, I suppose we would call it the imaginal faculty, actually. That's a kind of more philosophical way of putting it, perhaps. We can recognize within us this this ability to make these connections, to create images for our experiences, so that those experiences can become more substantial in a positive way, and also possibly communicable, though not necessarily. So, who is this magician and what does he do? Well, we had some readings about the building of Sanye Monastery, so I'm going to have a look at this event of the building of Sanye Monastery, see in what way Padma is functioning as a magician, and try and see in the, which ways those could be of help to us. Yeah, the monastery. First of all, the monastery. It's a temple stroke monastery. It's a symbol. It's a sacred space. It's more, I'd like to draw a distinction here between symbol and sign. A symbol is something which is itself, whereas a sign is just a kind of an indication of it. So we can say Tara is a symbol of love. And we can't point to love any more than pointing at Tara. Do you see what I mean? She is love. That's the best we can do. We look at Tara and we say, she is love. Look at Avalokiteshvara. He is compassion, and so on. So it's not so much that they're just a sign for it. Like the word love is a sign for something. It doesn't convey that that object itself. Whereas Tara conveys that object. Yeah? By reflecting on Tara, we feel that love. So she conveys it. It would be very hard just to reflect on the word love, although I suppose some people could do it, and have that, you know, come as strongly as reflecting on her. So the monastery is a symbol. It is something in itself, and it's a symbol for it's a symbol for the Pure Land. Actually, it's a symbol for what happens when we transcend ourselves. Now, I think very much in terms of renunciation and giving up. A lot of people don't like this idea of renunciation because they think, well, if I give up this and that and the other and other, what am I left with? Nothing. Just a kind of horrible, horrible, boring, dull void. However, that's not how it actually works. If you renounce this, that, the other, and the other, and the other, what happens is that your experience opens up. You experience the blue sky, you experience spaciousness, you experience shunyata, which isn't a thing, it's merely the absence of grasping. So one of my best realizations from Kriya Loka, actually, that not grasping is itself blissful. It's not, if you don't grasp, you can be blissful. Actually, not grasping is itself blissful. And that's one of the little kind of aphorisms that I hold on to in my life to remind me of the direction I'm going in. So, in a way, Sanye represents, in a rather more sophisticated manner, what happens when you transcend yourself, when you go beyond craving, or however one would like to think of it. It's also related to the mandala as well. The mandala is also a symbol of what happens once you let go of everything else. I once went to visit Robert Thurman. Are you familiar with him? He's the translator for the Dalai Lama. And he's got a fantastic collection of mandalas. And he showed me a Manjuvajra mandala. And he was telling me all about it. And it represents the world of Manjuvajra. Now, Manjuvajra is a transcendent being, not this one, but the other one, the one back there. He sort of lives in this transcendental world. And the mandala is the world that he lives in. But it's also a temple. When you visualize that mandala, you visualize it as a temple with Manjuvajra and his consort. He always has a consort, Manjuvajra. never in Yabyum, but she's always sitting down on the, just down to his, that side. So a mandala is another symbol of what is beyond the self. Now, in order to establish the Dharma in any place, the Indian tradition says that three teachers are needed. I bet you're familiar with these. There's the Manu, the Buddha, and the Guru. Now, the Manu is the lawgiver. So the Manu is the one who creates order out of chaos. So he's normally a king or a warrior. So he has to use physical force in order to establish some kind of civilization, some kind of humanity, out of the sort of crude animal human beings that we are. So we need the Manu to do that. Now, in the case of Padmasambhava's story and with Samye, the Manu is obviously King Tritsundetsan, because we didn't hear about this, but he has actually subdued Tibet. Tibet was a wild place before he came along. He subdued it. He's created order. So he's the Manu. He's established order. But what he then wants to do is to create a spiritual realm as well. So he calls him Shantarakshita, the abbot, the bhikkhu, the religious man, who in a way is like the Buddha. He comes in with spiritual principles, with doctrines, with teachings that he gives to the king to enable the king to help to start to create this realm. And this is all very good. You know, the Buddha comes along, he gives principles, people start practicing. What happens? Well, stuff happens. All sorts of things start to happen that are not there in the basic principles. So what you then need is the guru. The guru comes along and he takes the actual experience of actual people and directs that. So when they start to build Samye, evil forces arrive that Shantarakshita can't deal with. They're not part of the rational world that he exhibits in. His teaching is rational. He can't deal with these irrational forces. So what we need is Padma. We need the magician to start to deal with these irrational forces. Now, this happens in our own lives. Yeah, we've got the teachings. It's very rational. You know, we've got the four this, the five that, ten this, the eight that, the 12 this. They're all very reasonable. They all sound, all we've got to do is, yeah, tick them off one by one, tuk, 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 and we get enlightened. But somehow it doesn't work like that. Somehow there are other forces that come in and create problems, create difficulties. So how do we get at those forces? How do we get at those things? They are not within the realm of the rational. We can't get at them in the realm of the rational. So we have to use other methods. And this other method, of course, is the magical. Incidentally, I don't know if you know this, but in the building of the temple in Jerusalem, Solomon did exactly the same thing. He subdued demons and got them to work on the temple in Jerusalem. So I find this quite fascinating that the same image has grown up in two very different religious traditions. So it's clearly we're talking about something here that's sort of universal in our human psyches. So what did Padma do? Let's look at I'm going to look at the four things that he did that we heard about in our readings. First is he went to Tibet and he travelled around and subdued demons. The second thing was that he subjugated the king. He put the king in his place. The third thing was that he made a cooperation between the king of men and the king of the Nagas in order for the temple to be built. And the fourth thing he did was consecrate the temple, consecrate the Samye, and all the sort of gods and that come alive. So I want to look at those four things. Firstly, Padma got to Tibet a year before he went to see the king, and he travelled around all over the place, subduing various, all sorts of spirits, also really weird ones, some of them enormous, some of them with great gangs of followers, all sorts of difficult, creatures of all kinds. And this, I think, illustrates something about our psyches. Our psychic life, our spiritual life, is not a nice, ordered development. It's not you do this bit, and then you do that bit, and then you do that bit. It is much more chaotic than that. So you do a little bit here, and a little bit there, and a little bit here, and you've forgotten about this bit because it was 10 years ago, then suddenly it comes back in again. And so it's almost like, one of those painting by colours things. You know, you paint in one colour, and gradually sometimes you can see a little bit of what's going on in the picture. It's a chaotic, piecemeal, sometimes very dark process that we really don't understand. And this seems to me quite important, and to realise that we don't really understand what's going on in the depths of our psyche. It's chaotic. I mean, one of the things I've done recently is I've taken a particular theme of my inner life, and I've recalled all the occasions where I think there was a construction, a bit added to that theme. And it goes back 50 years to the first time. And then, you know, a few years later, there was something else which is clearly part of the same issue. And gradually over the years, you know, all these bits start to become clearer. And you can start to see that particular naga, if you like, that particular spirit comes into view. But it can take a very long time. So this idea of Padmasambhava travelling around all over the place in a rather haphazard and chaotic manner seems to me to be very illustrative of the kind of exactly what goes on in our own minds in our spiritual development. And the magician within, of course, has got to learn to sort of be able to deal with all of that and deal with the demons that come up. So, the spiritual life is chaotic. You deal with all these unconscious bits, particularly the unconscious bits. You deal with these in a very haphazard manner. And this was exactly what Padma was doing during that first year. Going round, picking off the things that he could, starting things in process. Remember, nearly all of these demons he gives a treasure to. So they've all got their value. They're all valuable. But they do need to be... I mean, he had to treat some of them quite violently. So, you know, you've got to be used to doing that. I remember Bhante once saying that he felt that, you know, we tend to think of Buddhism as a very peaceful religion. Well, I mean, it is in many ways. But there are times when you do have to be pretty aggressive on certain things. The next thing I'd like to touch on is the subjugation of the king. This is not an unusual situation where you've got kind of social authority against the demands of the imagination, let's put it that way, the demands of the magician. And who's gonna win? We experience this in the world, you know, unfortunately, it's very visible in the world, but we also experience it within our own psyches. You know, the ego is the sort of king, the conscious ego that likes to know what's going on, likes to be in control, all of that sort of stuff. And then there's the magician who's sort of bringing up these other forces. He's going to have to kind of meet the king and basically put him in his place, which is below the magician. So this is what Padmasambhava does. And he does it, the way he does it, is by recognising all of his qualities. You know, I say, I'm Padmasambhava with this quality. I'm Padmasambhava with this quality. Padmasambhava with this quality. I've done this in my spiritual life. I've done that. I've achieved this. I've seen that. I know this demon. I know that demon. And who are you? Ego. You know, you're nothing. You're just a kind of, you just want to, all you're interested in is keeping control and, you know, having people like you and being recognised and all that sort of stuff. So, I wish I could do lights out the end of my fingers. That would be great to do flames. That's why I got involved in Buddhism, really, to do flames out of it. But that's what he did. By his confidence, he just cut down the authority of the king. So that's what's needed to deal with the habitual self that likes to remain in control. We've got to develop our faith, our confidence in our spiritual attainments, actually, no matter what they are. Let's move on. The next thing that we read about was the whole issue about the lumber and the nagas. So the king is worried because there's no lumber. He's got practical concerns. Anyone building a Buddhist centre will know that this is true. You have practical concerns. You've got to know where to get the lumber, where to get the money. How's it all going to do? But the king is totally caught up in that. And because he's totally caught up in it, he's not going to succeed. He's been put onto that by a naga, you know, by one of these spirits. It's not helpful towards building Samye, although it's necessary. He breaks Padmasambhava's medicine. Padmasambhava is struggling with a naga. And a naga is a powerful unconscious force that's getting in the way of things. Padmasambhava is dealing with it. The imagination, if you like, is dealing with it, but is in the middle of the process. And then the conscious mind comes in and interrupts it and says, come on, you know, be sensible, you know, do a decent day's work in your life, you know, don't sit around meditating all day, or don't, you know, what's all this going off on retreat for 6 months of the year, you know, what kind of man are you? You ought to be out there working for, I don't know, this, that or the other. So there are all of these sort of more conscious, they're admirable, you know, the king needed the wood. It wasn't a forced thing. I mean, that was actually necessary to build Samye. But he was over-obsessed with it, and he wouldn't let Padma get on with his work. He interfered with Padma's work with the unconscious forces. So Padma says, well, we need a kind of, I forget what the word was, some sort of cooperation between the king of men and the king of nagas. In other words, some kind of cooperation between the conscious ordered mind and the unconscious chaotic forces. And that the magician, the imaginative person, is the one, the imagination is the one that's going to build that cooperation. So Padma agrees to do this. They go to, I think it's Lake Malgro, great big lake in the middle of Tibet. And the king and everyone's hidden up a valley. And Padma sets himself up. He does his rituals. He's sort of working away to do. Lakes in the life of Padmasambhava often represent the unconscious mind or higher states of consciousness. Padma's born from a lake, which is born from a higher state of consciousness. So it's sort of the lake is this higher state of consciousness, out of which comes a beautiful Dakini. And she agrees to take the message to the king of the Nagas. And because she'll do that, then the cooperation is formed. So the Naga himself doesn't appear. He stays down in the lake. But the Dakini is a kind of an intermediary between the conscious mind and the unconscious forces. So I'm going to say a bit more about Darkens on Tuesdays. I'm putting all these plugs in, you notice, for my talks. So the arrangement is done. That connection is somehow made. You could say it's like, well, you know, if you really feel there's something getting in your way in your life, well, then you can look at your dreams. You can look at things that come up in meditation. Personally, I use the I Ching, a nice, you know, it just gives you these answers. And it's amazing what you can read into them, but you're reading something into it from your own mind. So it's actually quite helpful. So, you know, in this way, you can sort of build a connection, build a relationship. You don't know what's going on down there, but you have some kind of connection with it. And what does that do? That stirs things up. That shakes things up. And all sorts of riches come out of that, which are then applicable to the main job of building the Samye. So remember, the when the Naga swirls around, all the riches, all the gold is thrown up on the shores of the lake, and the people can come and collect it. And the king gets a new wife. So it's sort of, you know, everything's fine, really. Everything works out well. So that is another way in which I think magic works for us. It's to try and build this relationship between the inner forces, which are balanced, no, not balanced, are in congruence with forces in the outside world. The last one I wanted to talk about is the bringing of the statues to life. This was actually sort of one of the things that got me kind of interested in Western magic and hermetic magic, because there's a text called the Asclepius in which it's described how the Egyptians would bring their statues to life. And what they did was they would make a statue of the particular god they wanted to communicate with. They would make the statue out of a suitable material, sometimes wood, sometimes stone, sometimes just clay, sometimes cloth, whatever material was appropriate for that god. They would build a statue out of that material. They would then offer it various fruits, incenses, precious stones, and so on, that again were relevant to that god. So they're starting to focus their attention on the god. They would then chant the spell, which was usually a short, repetitive phrase said over and over again. Yeah. And that would bring the statue to life. The statue would come to life, and they could ask it a question, and then it would go back to being the statue again. And I thought, wowee, that is what we do when we visualize, when we meditate. We evoke the statue. We make offerings. I mean, in my practice, I explicitly make offerings to Milarepa. And then we chant the mantra. And it does, it comes to life. You know, you do learn in a way to communicate with it. Again, none of this literal, measurable by scientific methods, but within the whole realm of the inner life and the imagination, it actually works. So I was thinking, well, this magic that these Egyptians were doing, it does actually work. It's something that we use within our own Buddhist tradition. And for some reason, I don't know why, that gave me more confidence than I'd had before. Yeah. For some reason, because the Egyptians have done it, I think what it appealed to my rational mind, actually. There was something about that that was perfectly rational. It wasn't crazy. It wasn't... I don't know. Something there gave me the confidence to really recognize the objective existence of the Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, Dakinis, and so on. So yes, visualization, shrines, this is all a method of building up a connection with the spirit represented by the Buddha, Amitabha, which is an actual force in the world, of building a resonance, a connection with that, within our own psyches and building that strong relationship, making in a way so that we can sort of eventually start putting ourselves aside and just recognize that we are a functioning of Tara, Avalokiteshvara, Vajrapani, Padmasambhava, and so on. So I think that those are the points I wanted to make, actually. Just to sort of sum up, really. Buddhism is often expressed in a very highly structured way. Threefold path, Noble Eightfold Path, 12 stages of conditioned co-production, positive spiral event, 10 fetters, nice relevant one. All of these different structures. It is very good at presenting itself in a neat and rational way. It's what appealed to me as a scientist. However, those doctrines are all absolutely essential and useful, but they don't represent what it's actually like. What it's like is much more chaotic, much more all over the place, and much more in a way out of our control. We set up the conditions and things will move forward, but we can't control how fast it's going to go. And each of us will form a different understanding of that path through the images, the approaches that are appropriate to our own spiritual lives. The images are usually mandalas. I think mandalas are more useful than sort of linear structures, because what you're doing with a mandala is you're working at various places around the mandala in order to move, as it were, towards the centre. Whereas with the structured things, they can be taken too literally. So I suppose what I would tend to do is I tend to mandalarise everything. You know, the Noble Eightfold Path to me is a mandala. The spiral path is a multi-mandala, and so on. So the one who can deal with this irrational process, this rather chaotic path, is the magician, and the magician within. He's grounded in firm teachings. Remember, don't forget, he wears the yellow robe of the bhikkhu. So he's grounded in those things. He's ethical. He hasn't dismissed all of that. He does all of that on the surface. But he also can do these other things. And he can help us find our way through this sort of labyrinth of our own personal growth. So we need to find him. We need to trust him. Trust our imaginations. Trust the chaotic nature of things. Trust the intuitions. And so on, without always having a sufficiently neat map of it. We were talking earlier, weren't we? I feel very much as though these days my life is governed by a compass point. I've got a really good compass point. I know where it's pointing. But I don't have a map. So I don't know what the territory's like. So I've got no idea what's going to happen. But I know roughly the direction it's pointing in. So if you like, the sort of the magical side is the compass. Compasses are magic, aren't they? And the maps are more rational. And sometimes we have to go without a map. Sometimes we can use a map, but don't ever take maps as being true representations of the territory that you're going across. And particularly within the psychic life, all of a sudden the territory can change, you know. You think you're in Denmark and you find you're in the Congo. It can be that sort of chaotic. So yes, we need to help. We need his help to find, subdue all the troublesome genies, to stand up to the tyranny of both external and internalized social conditioning, to provide ourselves with wealth and riches of the inner life. Because remember, the spiritual life is not a life of poverty. It's a life of great spiritual riches. And the ongoing guidance of the deities, the Buddhas, the Bodhisattvas, Dakinis, and others. So that's what I think we can learn from him. Padmasambhava says that he will appear to anyone that calls him. Yeah? And I, for one, believe that. I think that's true. I know that's true. So we'll call to him. And that is what we're going to do next. So we're going to have a short break, and then we're going to come in and call the Padma Sambhava.